Thank you, Brother Stan. Thank you, Brother Gregory. And once again, we have the privilege of sharing some of our meditations and thoughts, which have been part of our heart and our thoughts and thinking for the last many years. The walk in the narrow way is very, very special, as each of you know. And the time that we spend studying somehow gets terribly enhanced beyond our ability to appreciate sometimes just by the opportunity to share it with someone. As we all know from witnessing the Lord's goodness, just how much it means to us, how much more it means to us as a result of sharing our heartfelt understandings with others. And what we hope to do tonight is to share this afternoon our heartfelt understandings of the Lord's Word on these subjects, and try to bring together some thoughts that perhaps we haven't considered before, and give those some due consideration with a scriptural understanding of God's everlasting covenant. Since I brought all the greetings I could before, and I certainly want to tell you that Sister Rebecca and I have thoroughly enjoyed the privilege of being here with you. Some of you have met many years ago, some of you a few years ago, and the opportunity of being here has just been well spent. Got a chance to do some fencing yesterday. I thought that was really nice, going out there with Brian up on the hill to get the wires all lined up to give the animals something to think about when they got too close. It's kind of interesting. Maybe they get shocked, which is shocking. The small sheet, which I just want to take a moment to describe to you, if you have a copy of it, please take a look at it. This appeared in a reprint. In fact, you'll find it on page 4538, which is at the end of one of the years of reprints. And the reason I want you to look at it is because, to me, it's a very special diagram. And just very briefly mentioned, you notice how it mentions Eden first, a little small little box. And you literally have to turn your reprint upside down to read this part over here. If you had your book, you know, you turn your whole book upside down to see it. And it's very interesting because it talks about Adam having a relationship with God, and there was a promise for everlasting life. As you move through the patriarchal layers, you realize there's a box in there that's kind of stretched out across a period of time right down through the gospel age, where it talks about Abraham's oath-bound covenant. And Brother Russell was able, with this diagram, to show how God had offered to the Jewish nation and to those of us who are walking in the newness of light, opportunities for different kinds of life, but nevertheless, opportunities for life everlasting. And the millennial age will also offer such an opportunity. I encourage you to look this over, but this is really just to call it to your attention. We're not going to try to study this today, and I thought it would be good for you to see it and look at it with me. I encourage you to look at it in the book. It's about 10 or 20% larger, maybe 10% larger in the reprint. You'll be able to actually read it. This is awfully small. And so we're going to just put it aside now, and we'll just take the other handout, which is stapled together, a couple pages, and just realize what we have here. We have a series of numbers, and each of these boxes or charts runs on. And of course, as with everything else, there are little errors in it. You'll notice on the second page, one of the charts got a little too large for its own good and ran off the page. And I hope that hasn't happened too many times. But we'll be referring to this throughout the time of our lesson, and just want you to be familiar with that it's there and will be going on. Of course, the big question is the everlasting covenant the Abrahamic covenant, or what covenant is it? And in fact, we find this expression, everlasting covenant, to be applicable to different periods during the age. And in fact, there are some places where it mentions the law as an everlasting arrangement. And we know that that will have its end and need to be replaced. But in fact, it has that word to it. So we have to understand what everlasting means. But is this covenant, this everlasting covenant, is it the Abrahamic covenant or is it the new covenant? And the answer is yes. It's both, of course. It depends on how you understand the words, but it's both. It does refer to the Abrahamic covenant. In other scriptures, it refers to the new covenant. If you can look at chart with the stapled handout, you'll see that there are scriptures in Genesis, in Chronicles, and in Psalm which talk about it in the sense of him being the father of many nations, where God confirmed the covenant with Abraham, he confirmed it with Jacob and Israel. He also is the part of the Abrahamic covenant. And also he made with Abraham and confirmed it is mentioned in Psalm 105. But likewise, there are scriptures in Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Hebrews which speak of the new covenant. Such expressions as the sure mercies of David and going down to the time when he would establish the covenant in Ezekiel 16 with Judah, and of course bless the nations of the earth, including at that time, you know, it talks about Sodom and Gomorrah and so forth, Sodom and Samaria coming back and Israel being the older sister. Notice also, of course, it speaks of the new covenant in Hebrews 13 in this particular reference that we have there, the blood of it, making it perfect. We're not going into those details at this moment, but we wanted to give you that focus, that it does speak of both. Also, the Abrahamic covenant is everlasting because its blessings will be through the seed and will bless blessing others for eternity. That is important, everlasting because its blessings will be available for eternity. Another point that we'd like to emphasize is that the Abrahamic covenant is not the new covenant. It's the everlasting covenant, the Abrahamic covenant. An everlasting covenant is also the new covenant, but these are not the same. That is, the Abrahamic is not the new covenant. The one reference we didn't give you before, Isaiah 24, verse 5, speaks of the law covenant, in a sense, as an everlasting covenant. But it's a covenant that Israel broke. It was made with them. It could have been for a permanent, lasting life, but they broke it. Now, Christians in general recognize really only the two covenants, the Old Law Covenant and the New Law Covenant. Not to say that they're not aware of the fact that there is reference to the covenant made with the animals, for example, where God said this, he didn't destroy the earth anymore. But these are the two principal ones that most Christians refer to. And I don't think they spend much time thinking about the Abrahamic covenant or promise. But it is, Abrahamic covenant is the original and we could say the superior covenant, which the law and the new covenant were added to. How do we know that? Well, Galatians 3, 15-17 would be a place for us to start. So you don't want to turn there with me. Galatians 3, 15-17. With Galatians 3:8 that says that God would justify the heathen through faith and preach the gospel for unto Abraham, saying, in you the seed be blessed. But here in 15-17, brethren, I speak after the manner of men, though it be but a man's covenant, or testament, yet if it be confirmed, no man disannulleth or added thereto. Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made, he saith not, and to seeds of many, but as of one. And to thy seed, which is Christ. And this I say, that the covenant that was confirmed before of God, now that in Christ is not supposed to be there, the law which was 430 years after cannot disannul, that it should make the promise to none effect. So what we have here is a description of the Abrahamic promise, but it is also conceived of and understood to be a covenant. In Acts 3:25, and I'd like you to turn there with me, Acts 3:25, and if we're all there, I'll read, ye are the children, Acts 3:25, of the prophets, and of the covenant which God made with our fathers, saying unto Abraham, and in thy seed shall all the kindreds of the earth be blessed. So we want to understand that this is not just a promise that's made to Abraham, but it's a covenant. There's been some question about that, but in fact it is a covenant, and it can be viewed as such. Galatians 4 also identifies both Sarah and Hagar, and that helps us understand this picture and pattern also, because in Galatians 4, if we can take a look there real quickly, there is reference to these two women being descriptive of covenants, and that is helpful because then we realize that we're talking about something that's different from the average understanding. If you go back to, let's say, Galatians 4, 22, it speaks of Abraham had two sons, one by a bondmaid, the other by a free woman. And if we turn go to verse 24, which things are an allegory, for these are, now the New American Standard omits the word the, so it's for these are two covenants, the one from the Mount Sinai which generates the bondage, which is Hagar, and that would be, from Sinai, would be the law covenant. And for Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, an answer to Jerusalem, which now is, showing, by the way, that the law covenant was in operation when Paul wrote this. Hadn't finished. You know, we say Jesus nailed it to the cross. Well, yes, he did, but the Jews who didn't accept Christ were still under that law. So that covenant continues, and they're obligated to it even now. So he says, which now is, and is in bondage with her children. But the Jerusalem which is above is free, and is the mother of us, not all. That's omitted in Sinaitic, and it's verified by the New American Standard. So what we have here is a description of Abraham, and we have from this an add-on covenant, which is the covenant of the law. But we also have Sarah, who is, of course, it says, the mother of us. And what we think here is that those who have come into a relationship with Christ are depicted, as Paul is attempting to do for the Galatians, to show them that they have a relationship with God through Jesus, and Jesus, of course, is pictured by Isaac, the child of Sarah. So there is a connection here, and that's a covenant. We'd like to think in terms of Jesus also as a new creature, being developed as a new creature. And that little concept of Jesus being developed, as his footstep followers would be in this relationship, would come under this Sarah feature as a new creature. So I think that's important, and that it distinguished between him being pictured by any other covenant, or pictured in any other covenant in his relationship with us and our relationship with God. Now, of course, the old law covenant had passed away, or was about to pass away, because of its unprofitableness, Hebrews 8:13 and Hebrews 7:18. And I think it would be good for us to read those. Let's turn to Hebrews 4:7-18. For there is a very disannulling of the commandment going before, for the weakness and unprofitableness thereof. In other words, the law covenant was not functioning in a way that would be helpful to the Jewish nation to get them to life. And Hebrews 8:13 speaks of the new, not the new covenant, because that's an added word, but speaking of it, has made it first old. The fact that there is a new makes the other one old. And that which decayeth and waxeth old, it says, is ready to vanish away, but has not yet disappeared. So that leaves us with these two covenants that are everlasting. The one that will disappear completely, the law covenant, is out of the picture in terms of whether it's an everlasting covenant in the full sense of the word. Not. The Abrahamic is, and the new covenant is. So as we say, most Christians focus on the new and the old, but in this case, we want to introduce the Abrahamic covenant. Most Christians believe we're under the new covenant. That would be very consistent with their limited understanding of God's plan. Think about it. They don't see any future hope for the world, much less for Israel. So if we would ask them, what do you expect to happen in the future, they would describe that if you're not saved now, there's really no hope for you. So there really is no point in having some concept of a future provision of an everlasting or new covenant. They couldn't comprehend that. So those of us who understand that there is an opportunity for life in the kingdom, where the world of mankind is going to come back to life in a wholly new situation that's never existed before, we can see the purpose and value of a, quote, new covenant, from which the church with Christ are to be made the ministers. They are the ministers of this covenant and are now being prepared for that. And that's the essence of the direction we're going in. I'd like you to take a look at the chart again that we gave you a handout. Look at number 2. In 1909, Bill Russell commented on this statement. He said, we all inherited this general line of thought through Sunday school sermons, commentaries, and so forth. It is not strange, therefore, that all had this confused concept on the subject, as it took some of us, and he means himself in this concept, quite a while to get a proper focus on the Abrahamic covenant and the new covenant. It may now take some of us some considerable time to differentiate between the Abrahamic covenant and the new covenant. So he's explaining that he recognizes the problem that can exist, even for the brethren, to comprehend what the differences are between these. We might add to this that it's necessary for us to discern the ways in which the Almighty has spoken of his covenant with his people. So we come to a new question. In Galatians, we read about Sarah. So we ask ourselves, this is in the context of our discussion, who is our mother? If God is our father, who is our mother? And our mother, we believe, is described by this Abrahamic promise, which includes the first wife, Sarah, the original wife, the oldest wife, the wife who was barren for so long. Please turn with me to Isaiah 54. Isaiah 54. We'll go through Isaiah 54, we'll go to verse 1. And there we read, sing, O barren, thou that didst not bear, break forth into singing, and cry aloud, thou that did not travail with child. For more are the children of the desolate than the children of the married wife, saith the Lord. And this can be very confusing because here, in this case, the married wife is the one who had the children, the child, Hagar, but in the long run, in the big picture, Sarah, who appears at first in this context to be the barren one, is the one whose posterity, the population that will come as a benefit of her work and the covenant that will be in her name to start with, that will be reaching out, developing the church, will be greater than that of the Hagar covenant in the sense of their place in God's plan. She represented the oldest covenant. It was desolate for long, but the lessons are here from God, and he's taking his time. What seemingly was a hopeless condition will bring fruitage. And, you know, when we think about God working things out slowly, this is something that's supposed to teach us likewise a lesson. What's the lesson? The lesson of patience, the lesson of waiting to see what the Lord is doing over a period of time. This is a challenging concept, but it's true, and we'd like to apply some lessons to it. Sarah's covenant will produce more children than the married wife. Sarah's covenant will produce more children than the Hagar wife. And the only covenant that will eventually produce more in the long run, of course, will be the everlasting covenant, which is incorporated here. Hagar's covenant, we found out, was the one that pointed to Jerusalem and Mount Sinai. Sarah's to that which is above, and the one we are included in. So, the heavenly seed is spoken of as being 144,000. This is one of our understandings from Scripture. And yet, we know that we could say even the great company could be possibly included in our understanding, but there's also a blessing that comes through the original inheritance that goes beyond this. And that comes in a different way. After Sarah died, the scriptures tell us in Genesis 25, and we might return to Genesis 25, we have several verses to read here, but we'll go first to Genesis 25:5. Abraham gave all that he had unto Isaac. Even though there was Ishmael born of Hagar, then Isaac born to Sarah, and there was another wife who had many children. He still gave all he had to Isaac. Isaac again pictures Jesus. And so the prosperity of this covenant goes through the son Isaac, who then will distribute to the others. Now, the covenant with Abraham through Sarah, the long-bearing one, represents the entire Abrahamic covenant, both the spiritual and the earthly, the stars of heaven and the sand of the sea. Sarah dies, as we said, and Abraham marries Keturah. Let's go back to 25:1. In 25:1, Genesis, then again, I think the again is very important, then again, Abraham took a wife, and her name was Keturah. Now, there's a premise we're laying here. There is no mention of Keturah in Galatians 4. In Galatians 4, it speaks of Sarah and Hagar. But in principle, we understand that they represent two covenants. And yet, there is prosperity of family growth, so to speak, by Abraham having children by Keturah. And I believe Brother Russell made a very logical conclusion when he stepped in the direction of seeing that Keturah here pictured the covenant that is not pictured by either Sarah or by Hagar. This third wife indeed pictures yet another covenant. So let's read the scripture. Then we can read Genesis 24:67, but I'll just read it to you quickly. And Isaac brought her, Rebekah, into his mother Sarah's tent, took Rebekah, she became his wife, and he loved her, and Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. This marriage of the antitypical Isaac is important for us to conceptualize, and what does it mean? If Keturah is in some way our mother, then Sarah is dead, the marriage of the antitypical Isaac is complete, Jesus' marriage is consummated, and we're left behind, if we take that concept and follow it through. So clearly, there's a process still going on. The church is still being developed, as we said earlier. And we feel that this other wife, in fact, pictures a relationship for which Christ and his church have been prepared to provide blessings. And we're going to be looking at a little bit more of that as we continue. The chart that you have has a diagram at the bottom of the first page. In other words, there is a promise through Sarah, and this is Galatians 4, the spiritual seed. And we have Hagar mentioned there, but we have her crossed out for a reason, not because we don't like her, but because she just doesn't play into this larger picture. The covenant that she's pictured, the law covenant, which is Israel, we know that will come to an end. Why? Because we realize that as the Jewish people come away from not believing in Jesus to believing, they are dead to the law. There's no relationship anymore. So that will pass away. And again, the only prosperity that we can see of for mankind is coming through this other Keturah wife, who becomes a description for us of another extension of the Abrahamic covenant. Now, just to continue, we've mentioned a good portion of what we were about to pass by here in my notes, so I just think I'm just going to move a little ahead. When Sarah's seed inherits the desolate parts of the earth, her seed Isaac distributes the blessings to Keturah's children. Remember what we said back in the fifth verse, that Isaac received everything. And that's clear, Jesus receives everything. But there's a blessing that's going to go out to the other children as well.
So you feel Keturah here, scripturally so, is a brand new covenant. And we, of course, have found this by the extension of the picture in Galatians 4. We are the children of the older covenant, and as it says in Galatians 3:28, now we, brethren, as Isaac was, are children of the promise. The new wife, Keturah, we think is describing the new covenant of Jeremiah 31. And I'd like to turn with you to Jeremiah chapter 31 and look at the verses and see how this is structured. So if you will turn with me, we'll read at least verses 1 and 5 to start with. Jeremiah chapter 31. Inside of the chart, you'll see chart number 4, and we have summarized basically what we're going to be going through, but I still would like to read the text with you, so if you will stay with me on the whole text, we can do that. I marked 1 to 10 here, but I want to just read portions of it. First verse 1, at the same time, saith the Lord, will I be the God of all the families of Israel, and they shall be my people. Verse 5, thou shalt yet plant vines upon the mountains of Samaria. The planter shall plant and shall eat them as common things. By the way, Wes Cramer was part of the group that planted vineyard in Samaria on the last trip that the brethren made there. We were in Gaza, Rebecca and I, visiting some of the Jewish settlements there. Jeremiah 31, 8, let's go to verse 8. For behold, I will bring them from the north country and gather them from the coasts of the earth, and with them the blind, the lame, the woman, the child, and her that travaileth with child together, a great company shall return thither. Verse 10, hear the words of the Lord, O ye nations, and declare the isles afar off, and say, he that scattereth Israel will gather him and keep him, as a shepherd doth his flock. So we see the gathering and the restoration. This, we believe, of course, has happened in the past century, and they have, in fact, been brought back. This gives us a little bit of a sense of context here. Verse 31, 15 and 16, let's read that together also. Thus saith the Lord, a voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping, Rachel weeping for her children, refused to be comforted for her children, because they were not. Thus saith the Lord, refrain thy voice from weeping, and thy eyes from tears, for thy work shall be rewarded, saith the Lord, and they shall come again from the land of the enemy. Now, this is a possible, I'm extending the thought here, because this is certainly not something that was taught before the Holocaust, but this is even possibly, by extension, a reference to the tragedies of the Holocaust, and the resurrection, which clearly only be the only comfort. If you'd lost somebody in the Holocaust, you would probably find very little comfort at all in anything. Some of the folks who've been through it have completely lost all faith. Others have had their faith strengthened, but generally speaking, to be comforted from something like that is very hard. But something like this, the coming back from the land of the enemy, will be the only real comfort. Let's go to verses 29 and 30, Jeremiah 31. In those days, they shall say no more, the fathers have eaten a sour grape, and the children's teeth are set on edge. But every one shall die for his own iniquity, every man that eateth the sour grape, his teeth shall be set on edge. And we understand, of course, this is the time when, after the complete payment of the ransom is made, the mediatorial kingdom will be established, and individuals will die because of their own iniquity, if they're going to die at all. Now, verse 31 is a very critical text, and we'd like to read that. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. This is a covenant, of course, that is going to be made with the house of Israel and Judah, whom he has been speaking about in the context of this chapter. We realize this is natural Israel. We realize this is something that has to take place with respect to people who are brought back to the land. And one of the ways we can be sure of this is that if we were to just remember in our minds the way the Lord treats the subject in Ezekiel chapter 20, we would remember that he says he's going to return as king. Now think about that. He's going to return. I'll take a moment to read it with you. Let's just turn there a second. I think it's an important connector. In Ezekiel chapter 20, as I live, verse 33, as I live, saith the Lord, surely with a mighty hand and with a stretched out arm and with fury poured out, I will rule over you. Now that means reign. If we make a connection between this and what's actually been happening, I'll bring you out from the people and will gather you from the countries where you were scattered with a mighty hand and a stretched out arm with fury poured out. I'll bring you into the wilderness of the people. I will plead with you face to face, like I pleaded with your fathers in the wilderness in the land of Egypt. And so will I plead with you. Will cause you to pass under the rod. It will purge out the rebels. I'm skipping down. And of course he says here that he will, as you go on, he will establish his relationship with them. What's beautiful about this is that we realize that here in Ezekiel, he's describing, God is describing his work with Israel. Now you say, well, it's God. That's Jehovah God. But it's not just Jehovah God, it's his right arm also. So we're really talking here about Jehovah God working through his mighty arm, Jesus. And you remember in Daniel 12, verse 1, Michael shall stand up. All you have to do is look at chapter 11 to realize that in chapter 11, every time a king stands up, it means he came to reign. If you look at chapter 12, Michael stands up. Guess what he's doing? Just what it said in Ezekiel 20. He's going to rule over them, and he's going to reign over them as a king. So we have this basis. When you look at 31, and you see them already being brought back to the land, he's going to establish his covenant with them. We recognize that the covenant is made with Israel, who is gathered back to the land by the returned and reigning Lord. But the question is, how will this all take place, of course? Let's look at verse 32. Not according to the covenant I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they break. Although I was an husband to them, saith the Lord. So here he is literally considering himself like a husband. And if you remember the way he had Hosea marry a harlot and go through this whole process with her, where she eventually runs away and he takes her back, God is saying, I had a relationship with this nation, they played the harlot, but I'm bringing them back again, and bringing them back and establishing my covenant with them, not with Christians, not with believers, but with the ones who needed to be chastened, the ones who were playing the harlot. And that's why in Hosea, he offers them a sort of an engagement present. You read Hosea 2, 14 and 15, you see he gives them the valley of Achor. What for? To encourage them. You know what the valley of Achor has to do with? Because he gives them the gate of hope. Petitifa, the place that was established when the Jewish people came back to the land, the place that was established as the first settlement owned by Jewish people in the Holy Land since the days of the centuries past. Now, where are we coming with this? Well, we've come to the point where we realize that the new covenant is replacing the old covenant. We remember that the Apostle Paul said it's about to pass away. So evidently we've gone from the days when Jesus died on the cross all the way down to Paul, and he says it's about to pass away. He spoke of it as still existing in his day. Here it speaks of the time when this will be replaced by the new covenant, and it's being made with the house of Judah and the house of Israel. Verse 33. But this shall be the covenant that I will make with them after those days. After those days, saith the Lord, I will put my law in their inward parts and write it in their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. After those days, after the gospel age and the seven times of punishment, the Lord will change their hearts. Verse 34. And they shall no more teach every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, Know ye the Lord, for they will all know me from the least unto the greatest of them, saith the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity, I will remember their sin no more. What does this possibly mean? He's talking about a time when no one has to share this knowledge with anyone else. They'll all know him. Now, if I were to speak to someone in the churches and say, has this gone into effect? And they say, yes. And I would say, now, wait a minute. You mean to say everybody out here knows the word of the Lord from the least unto the greatest? Has all this sin and iniquity been forgiven? This hasn't happened yet. And so, in fact, it will. And that will take place after those days. After those days. After the times of punishment. The times when they would go through the period of trouble, the time when they would be confounded by the nations. Remember, they were warned very clearly back in the days of Moses that if they violate the law, they're going to go through a lot of trouble. And that, in fact, came upon them. But after those days, these things would be turned around. Now, we just suggest, and see, maybe I can go a little further here. Notice on the chart, we mentioned verses 35 to 40, that the nation of Israel will last as long as the ordinances of the sun, moon, and stars never be plucked up, never thrown away. The nation of Israel will endure everlastingly. God intends, as it says in Jeremiah 30, though he make a full end of all nations, he will not make an end of them. He punished them. He scattered them, but he lured them back to himself, as it says in Hosea. He had the church speak comfortably to them, Isaiah 40, verses 1 and 2. So, look a little further. Can we fit the church under this new covenant in this context of Jeremiah 31? Is there any level of application where we can fit the new creation in? You might ask the question, does the church not also have forgiveness of sins? Doesn't it have knowledge of the Lord, as it says here? Do they not have the law written in their hearts? And the answer is, of course they do. But would we be not surprised to find that those who are to educate and heal and bless the nations would be devoid of this, that they would not have this? We believe that other references also promise a likewise future blessing. But the church are the ransomed of the Lord. The church have also come to Zion. They've also obtained joy and gladness. But would we then apply the scriptures of Isaiah 35 to the church because of similarities? Of course not. The Isaiah 35 picture is the bringing back of the world and mankind to live in prosperity on the earth. And yet, we have many of those. We have been benefited by the Lord's ransom. We have come to Zion. We have joy. We have gladness. But that doesn't apply to us. And even these other thoughts about knowing the Lord and having sins forgiven. There are things in the context which make that Isaiah 35 exclusively a kingdom picture. And we might add the thought that another example would be, by contrast, and I mentioned this earlier today, in the parable of the sheep and the goats. Clearly, the parable of the sheep and the goats is future. But there are principles in the parable of the sheep and the goats. And those principles should apply at any age. Principles of interacting with others in a way that is helpful, encouraging, and a blessing. And we should never put aside principles like that and think that we don't have to follow through with them. So there are similarities in how the word of the Lord will affect the change in the lives of the world under the new covenant and the way the church is developed under the Sarah feature of the Abrahamic covenant. We being under the Sarah feature of the Abrahamic covenant, and there are similarities between that and the new covenant. Forgiveness of sin, change of heart, knowledge of God, but that does not make them the same covenants. we would expect similarities. Remember, if the church is to give these things to the world, they must first have them. And that, by the way, is what Brother Russell said on page 5292. If the church are to give these things, they must first have them. Turn with me back to Isaiah. Isaiah 49. I'd like to read three verses there. Isaiah 49, verses 8, 9, and 10. Thus saith the Lord, in an acceptable time have I heard thee, and in a day of salvation, and emphasize a day of salvation, have I helped thee. And I will preserve thee, and I will keep with thee for a covenant of the people, to establish the earth, to cause to inherit the desolate heritages. That thou mayest say to the prisoners, go forth to them that are in darkness, show yourselves. They shall feed in the ways, and their pastures shall be in all high places. They shall not hunger nor thirst, neither shall the hand of the sun smite them, for he that hath mercy on them shall lead them, even by the springs of waters shall he guide them. Just think about the thrilling prospect of being part of the mediator of a covenant which will release the prisoners from the grave and stop the hungering. Jeremiah 31 is not applicable to the gospel age, but it applies, as the scripture says, to after those days. And Jeremiah 31 is in fact described by his third wife, Keturah. Abraham, Sarah, Abraham, Hagar, which will come to an end, and Abraham and Keturah. So this one, we believe, pictures the new covenant. Jeremiah 31 and Keturah. Now, principles may apply out of context at time, but it doesn't mean that the scriptures have a different time application. There are different levels of fulfillment, but the scriptures should not be bent or viewed as flexible to the point where everything changes in our understanding. Thus, even though we could say certain effects of the new covenant, such as forgiveness of sin, apply to the church, this does not mean that the church in some way is under that covenant, like the world will be in the kingdom after those days. Now, one might ask about the Apostle Paul's analogy in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, and I'd like you to look again at the chart. This is on the second page, number 5. One might ask the question, isn't Paul making an application of Jeremiah's new covenant to the church in this day? So let's read. Well, there's a lot to read here. I don't know if we're going to have time to read it all. But 2 Corinthians chapter 3. I'll read a few verses at least. Paul is, of course, talking to the Corinthians and reviewing with them the problem he has, because there are those who are coming along and saying, you know, who's this Apostle Paul? And he says, do we have to commend ourselves to you again, as some others, with epistles or letters of recommendation, like carrying your resume with you? Does Paul have to carry a resume back to the church that he founded? Now, that's basically what he's saying. He says, you are the epistle. In other words, your existence is my commendation. You are the letter that I would need to recommend myself to you. This is a very strange thing to say. And then we go on. For as much as you are manifestly, verse 3, to be declared, to be the epistle of Christ ministered by us, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not in tables of stone, but in the fleshly tables of the heart. And such trust have we through Christ to God, toward God, if you wish. Not that we are sufficient of ourselves to think anything of ourselves, but our sufficiency is of God, who also hath made us able ministers of the New Testament, the New Covenant, not to the letter, but the Spirit, for the letter killeth, but the Spirit giveth life. Now, we're going to just pause there a moment. Prophecies that are given have different applications. We know that, for example, when there's a prophecy about the child, the Messiah, being harmed, Peter applies this in one of his references. John and Peter are speaking about Psalm 2, applying the heathen raging in Acts 4. Now, we know that this can be done in different senses. There can be different time periods are applied to. But this particular case in 1 Corinthians, or 2 Corinthians 3, has an important lesson for us. And the lesson is, as we read through this, and as we go down through the context, and I'd like you to go down in the same chapter, it speaks of us as being, verse 6, able ministers of the new covenant. Now later it speaks about Moses, for example, verse 13, not as Moses, which put a veil over his face, that the children of Israel could not steadfastly look to the end of that which is abolished. There's a reason for mentioning Moses here. What is Moses doing up in the mountain? He's getting the law. If we are to be the replacements, we are to be associated with Christ as part of his inheritance, and associated with him in the mediatorship, as it seems to be describing with verse 6, ye are able ministers of the new covenant. Then, as Moses, we have to be prepared for this. We're certainly not ready at this point while we're in the flesh, but we're being prepared. So the object lesson of this chapter is we are being prepared as ministers of a covenant. And in a sense, you could say, this hasn't gone into effect yet because we're still up in the mountain. We haven't come down yet. The Lord isn't finished with us. Just as Moses was able to provide the law and to dispense it to the people while he was up in the mountain, so likewise we are not able to come down. And that's without going into all the details of the context, which would take a bit of time, and I don't know that we're going to do that. So what was the exact analogy? I'd like you to look at the chart with me. Moses has a veil over his face. The antitype of that is the world will not see the glorified Moses class veiled to their sight. The ancient rulers, in fact, will represent the church on this side of the veil. And Paul applies this to the Jews being still blind in their day. They were blind in his day. But the lesson for us is that this glorified Moses, which the world will eventually see, still needs to be prepared. Notice the second point on the chart. God writing the second tables in stone for Moses. The world will have the law written in their hearts, but the church, ministers of reconciliation, are prepared first to be the mediator or part of the mediator of the new covenant. Now, again, Moses in the mountain, there are a lot of other things happening. Notice the other three that I have listed here. The trumpets, the morning of the third day, the mountain burning and quaking, and the blood sprinkling the book of the people. And the antitype, by the way, Paul in this chapter doesn't make any reference to that. That's important for us to notice also. But in the antitype, there will be an inauguration of the new law covenant. And I'm introducing the word law covenant there because as the old law covenant was a law covenant, so likewise the new covenant will be a new law covenant because they'll be expected to obey the laws of God much as Israel was expected. And these other things that are the mountain burning pictures the time of trouble, and the sprinkling of blood will picture the final providing a payment of the ransom price and providing for the sprinkling of the people with the blood and the blessing of the world and the kingdom. Let's see. Try to remember this imagery of us being up in the mountain. I think it's very helpful. If we keep that in mind, we recognize that we know we're not finished. We know we're still here in the flesh. We know we're supposed to work with Christ. We know he's the mediator of a better covenant. But we also recognize some other little details about mediatorship. And it's a very fundamental concept. Mediators exist between individuals who are not in some kind of a good relationship. First John chapter 3, verses 1 and 2 tells us that that does not yet appear what we'll be like. But when we see him, we'll see him as he is, because we're going to be like him. Well, in that context, it says, behold, what manner of love the Father hath bestowed upon us, that we should be the sons of God. This is a relationship that doesn't require a mediator. We come into God because God has drawn us to Christ, and we have a relationship as sons. And yet the world, we know, needs a mediator, because in the kingdom, they will still have a lot to work out in their life. They need somebody to stand between them. Lest, remember, there's not going to be any Day of Atonement sacrifices sprinkling blood for them, literally, the way Israel had, but rather they will have the benefit of that Atonement Day class that will be there in the kingdom to represent them, so to speak, and keep them alive while they're being prepared to eventually meet, so to speak, with God, in the sense of being complete in their relationship and being able to stand before him and not sin. Okay. How appropriate is it then to think in terms of the ministers of reconciliation having the law first written in their hearts before they administer it to the world? You know, every time we see a tragedy in the world, every time we recognize there's suffering, sorrow upon sorrow, we should be prepared to seek the Lord the more, so that we can be the better prepared to have this law engraved in our hearts, to be prepared to have that relationship. Now, Brother Sam has been telling me that he's been corresponding with a man who's got some real difficulties in a prison. Without that contact with somebody who's going through an awful time, and maybe responsible for some awful things in his life, I don't know the details, this individual, we're touched by this, in a sense, like Jesus was touched with the feeling of the world's infirmities, we also are coming in contact with this. We benefit from this. So we desire to hasten with all earnestness to make our calling and election sure, so that we might help prepare ourselves and each other to be ministers of reconciliation, so that the wonders and beauties of the new covenant can be put into operation once completely sealed and made operative. So we come to a point where we pause again, we ask ourselves some other questions. Some have thought that, well, Romans 11 sort of ties it together and connects the little remnant of Israel at Jesus' time with this promise of a covenant, and it ties them together and says, well, that's what's operative. Romans 11, of course, is a very beautiful chapter. It's a masterpiece of logic, and we'd like to look at it with you. First, just to go back in Romans 11 to verse 7. Israel had not obtained that which he seeketh for, but the election had obtained it, and the rest were blinded. Well, this is a little remnant class, and we know there were Jews who accepted Christ. There's no question about that. But did the Lord make a new covenant with them at that time? Are they the remnant? Are they a piece of this new covenant activity? We think not. And the reason for that is, he does talk about blindness here. He talks about the ingrafting, of course, in verse 17, if you look there with me. Some of the branches were broken off, then thou, being a wild olive tree, were grafted in among them, and with them partakers of the root and fatness of the olive tree. But he speaks of the time of ungodliness that would be turned away from Jacob by his covenant. And that's an important point to remember. We have to get this thing into a proper time context. In other words, it's easy to look at time, such as the chart of the ages, and say, here's a scripture, and read it, let's say Isaiah 35, and say, oh, that's applying now. Well, if we don't apply it at the right time, it makes no sense. Scriptures need to be applied in their proper place and time. And the same with this. Let's take a look at verse 26 and 27. And so it says, well, go through 25. I would not, brethren, that you should be ignorant of the mystery, lest you be wise in your own conceit. The blindness in part has happened unto Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. So evidently we're talking here about the completion of the church and the blindness of Israel until that time. But then Paul says, and so all Israel shall be saved, as it is written. Now, Brother God mentioned before to us about the first verse of chapter 10. Brethren, my heart's desire is to pray to Israel that they might be saved. Well, here's the story. Verse 26, they will be saved. All Israel will be saved, it says. And why? Because the deliverer will come forth and turn ungodliness away from Jacob. So all Israel shall be saved, it is written. There shall come a deliverer out of Zion, and Zion shall come a deliverer, and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. For this is my covenant unto them, when I will take away their sins. Now, if you look at the chart with me just for a moment, the question is the apostle quoting from two texts in Isaiah to show one aspect of the new covenant would be poured out with the Holy Spirit at Pentecost? And my answer, of course, is no. The conclusion I have is that Isaiah and Jeremiah and Paul are teaching this new covenant as future. Look at the chart itself. In Isaiah 59, 20 and 21, it speaks about the time when the Redeemer will come to Zion and turn them that turn from transgression, excuse me, and unto them that turn from transgression in Jacob. As for me, this is my covenant with them. And then if you read down below that, Isaiah 27, Israel shall blossom in bud, and in the bottom line again, they'll be taking away his sin. Now, some have suggested that this Romans text is just those two texts, have nothing to do with anything else. But Isaiah preceded Jeremiah, and Jeremiah seems to codify this in one expression which we already studied and read this morning, this afternoon. 31 to 34, talks about the making of the new covenant with the house of Israel, with the house of Judah, and then, I will forgive their iniquity, I will remember their sin no more. I think Jeremiah has pulled together the concepts, by the Lord's grace, of Isaiah 59 and Isaiah 27. So, what's happening, look at the bottom of column 1, Isaiah is not prophesying about the spirit of Pentecost on a remnant of Jews, but when Israel's sins are taken away by my covenant and the spirit poured out on Israel forever. How do we know that? Well, look at the... And I think Jeremiah carries the same thought through that this covenant will be made after those days with, of course, Judah and Israel. And Paul is, I think, again, picking up the same theme, saying this will happen. Paul, you know, was so intense about Israel that in chapter 9, he virtually says, if it were possible, I would be accursed of God that my brethren would be able to understand. But he knew God's plan well enough to know that it wasn't going to happen until the fullness of the Gentiles came in, and then the covenant would in fact be made. Notice under Jeremiah's column, how will it take place? And I said, Jeremiah merges these texts to explain that the new covenant would be taking away the sin. And then finally, when did this happen? And I believe, of course, this is future. Not just the remnant, but when the church is complete, all Israel will get the benefits of this. So that's just a little discussion of Romans 11, which is, as I say, a most beautiful chapter. And they will benefit by, it says in the scriptures, by your mercy will they receive mercy. Have we received mercy? Surely we have. And they will receive mercy as a result of that, and the Lord will bless them. With whom is it made? Is it made with Judah and Israel? or just Judah? Is it made at the ancient worthies? Is it made at the world of mankind or with individuals? Or is it made with the mediator? Let's look at chart number 7. This is not necessarily an order of importance or of time, but it certainly is a list, and you can take a look at it with me this way. In Jeremiah 31, we believe we see clearly that it's to be made with Judah and Israel. Okay, we mention that in the first part of the chart. I will make a new covenant with, and it's talking about Judah and Israel. And if you look at those other scriptures, which we're not going to look up completely here, we see Jeremiah, Hosea, and so forth describing that relationship. And the bottom line is to be made with all Israel, not just one or the other. If you go to Ezekiel chapter 16, and I think it's worth turning here, I hope we have time. Ezekiel chapter 16. Talks about the word of the Lord came saying unto me, the Son of Man, cause Jerusalem to know her abominations. The 10-tribe kingdom was already in captivity. He's speaking to Jerusalem, which is the capital of Judah. Now, that's important because one might want to sort out and say, well, he's not talking to all of Israel, he's just talking to Judah. I don't think so. I think he's speaking to them as the final representatives because the others were taken away. Now, that is going to be a couple of pages you might have to turn, but go to verse 49. Behold, this is the iniquity of thy sister Sodom. Judah, principally, is being spoken to. And Sodom is called her sister. And it describes how she was behaving. They were, if you will, sisters in crime. They did some bad things. So skip down to verse 60. Nevertheless, it says, I, God, will remember my covenant with thee in the days of thy youth. Now what covenant would that be but the law covenant? And I will establish unto thee an everlasting covenant, evidently another covenant, family covenant. And, of course, Sodom will be, as you read in the context, her daughter. So from my standpoint, the new covenant is made with Judah, the prominent tribe that was still surviving. But Ezekiel explains in the 37th chapter that the bones that are going to be regathered are not just Judah's bones, but they're the whole house of Israel. And he doesn't mean there Judah and Israel, because they will be one. It's all together that are being described as coming together. And then, of course, in a very strange use of language, God will remarry Israel by the new covenant agreement. That would seem very strange. But remember what Hosea went through. He's told, marry the harlot, have children, she runs away, plays the harlot, he takes her back, he lures her back. God says, that's what I'm doing with Israel. And then he wants to make this covenant with them. Let's take a look at Hosea just quickly and look at the actual language there. And it's a very strange example. Hosea was horrified. We have to do this. But God is telling you that that's what I've been going through. Now, verse 14, now behold, I will allure her, bring her back into the wilderness, and speak comfortably or friendly to her. I'll give her the vineyards from thence, valley of Acorn, and doorful Petatikva, and she shall stand there as in the days of her youth, the day that she came up out of Egypt. So clearly it's future, and in the expression, you shall no longer call me Ishi, which is, she will call him Ishi, which is husband, and no longer call him Lord. In other words, God intends to bring them into this close relationship. And look at verse 19. I will betroth thee, Israel, unto me forever. This is the time of the bonding of that covenant, the new covenant that's spoken of in Jeremiah 31. It is future. What about the ancient worthies? On our chart, we also have the ancient worthies listed. What about them? With their better resurrection, will they come forth instantly perfect? To the natural leaders? Yes, they will come forth in a very special relationship to God. What about the rest of the people who are there? Imagine, for example, in the kingdom, a man who's a Chinese Buddhist or someone living in communist China being confronted with these ancient worthies, Elijah, Moses. Elijah who? The Jewish people, every year at Passover, what do? They pour a cup for who? Elijah. They open the door for who? Elijah. This is all a part of their understanding. They will know who these individuals are. Israel as a nation will acclaim these heroes. They'll acknowledge them. And they'll be teachers. They will also benefit from the instructions of the better mediator. The new covenant will be inaugurated with Israel through these ancient worthies, though it will be made with the nation. Can you say that it's made with the mediator? Well, you could. Brother Russell did, and some have made quite a big issue of this. I don't agree with the conclusion completely, because there's more to it. It's really made with Israel. But Brother Russell did say at one point, the new covenant with Israel will not be made with them directly, but with their mediator. We will stand between them. Well, we all accept that. That's a fact. But it's not made with them on behalf of Israel. It's made with Israel and just through the mediator. We'll leave it at that without going any further. If you want that reference, it's 4640 in the reference. Brother Russell explained that the new covenant will not be made with the millions of individuals during the millennial age, but Israel and the nations will be in the safe hands of the mediator during that time. And when the mediator steps aside, the world will be on their own, so to speak, and will have to choose to life to live forever. A final concluding analysis will be from Hebrews 11, and now I'm going to turn with me to chart 8. I'm sorry, did I say Hebrews 8? Oh, I did. Wow. I don't know why I said that. New covenant in the book of Hebrews, Hebrews 9. Apostle Paul pretty much finalizes some of our thoughts here. He combines the antitype of the inauguration of the law covenant and the Day of Atonement, as well as the consecration of priesthood. Now, I'd like to just get a picture in your minds. Picture Moses on the day of the inauguration of the law covenant. He's doing something there, and he's establishing a relationship. That relationship brings Israel into a bond with God. What happened every year on the 10th of Tishri? They had Day of Atonement. It's called Yom Kippur now. So every year on Yom Kippur, they renewed this relationship that was established with all this activity back at Mount Sinai. That's an important concept to establish, because that's exactly what they're doing. In order to be ready, they had to have all this work prepared for them so they could go forth for another year. And no, it doesn't take away all the sins, but that's the way the picture is created. I'd like you also to think of the whole book of Hebrews as a basic picture designed to show the difference between the old law covenant and the new law covenant with a new mediator, a better mediator. Why? Well, a lot of Jewish Christians were still hung up on a very big problem. They thought they should still belong to the priests, and the apostle has to go through the trouble of explaining to them, you are from the priesthood of Melchizedek, Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek, Levi was in his loins, don't you get the picture, brethren? You're with Melchizedek, they're supposed to pay tithes to you, not you to them. Because some of the brethren were still going back to the temple, thinking they had to worship at the temple and pay respect to these priests. And in fact, it should have been the other way around. They should be recognizing Christ, the new which of course eventually they will. So what Moses could not do as a mediator, Christ can. And what the animal sacrifices could not do, Christ has and is doing. In Hebrews 8, let's turn that. Hebrews 8, verse 6. We hear the following. But now he hath obtained a more excellent ministry, by how much more also he is the mediator of a better covenant, which is established upon better promises. Now this is an important text. Established, if we look at the meaning of the word, means legislated or enacted. In other words, let's say the state legislature here passes a law. And they say that on July 1st of this year, everyone, you pay personal property tax? On your personal property, they evaluate your property? I see no's and I see yes's. Do they evaluate the value of your house and does the state tax your, okay. All right, well, they're going to say, as of July 1st then, I'm going to turn it the other way around, there's not going to be any such law anymore. The only taxes on people in this state is gasoline tax. Okay? That's the only tax. Everything else is abolished. Now, it's passed today, or tomorrow, rather, signed by the governor. It's all set to go. But we have the rest of May, or rather, April, May, and June to go through. And it's not going to happen. Not until July 1st will this tax burden end. Or you could have made this another way, any kind of a law, but that's essentially the law. And I'm sure everybody would be very happy not to pay taxes. But in fact, that's the way it is. So we ask, if Jesus has already, if this process has already been established, why isn't it going into effect, as we're suggesting? Why are we waiting for this to still be established? Well, let's look at chapter 9, verse 16. For where a testament is, there must also be a necessity of the death of the testator. And the logic of this is such that the one who makes this testament, the one who bequeaths something, must die before it can go into effect. And I think you understand the concept. But Paul brings into this discussion the Day of Atonement sacrifices of calves, young bulls, and goats, telling us, in effect, that we're still waiting for the blood of the goat, the Christ, the mediator body, the mediator body. Christ is the head, the rest of the body is still being prepared, and it's growing day by day. Just like the blood of the Lord's goat representing the church sprinkled on the mercy seat, it is sprinkled on the books at the foot of Mount Sinai. Now, this is very interesting. This expression about the blood of bulls and goats, calves and goats, it's a longer process, but this is actually referring to that connection I tried to make before with you, that there is established an ordinance. Moses was back at Mount Sinai doing all of this to establish the immediate relationship with the nation of Israel and God. Every year they went back at the Day of Atonement and they reestablished that by the sprinkling of blood of bulls and goats, calves and goats. Clearly there is a comparison between what happened at Mount Sinai, what happens on the Day of Atonement. And the repetitiveness involves these several animals. And there's more in the story. First, justice is satisfied. Atonement is made. And then something happens. It's as if there's a mystery who is this mediator. But all the people are sprinkled. How long does it take to sprinkle the tens of billions? No, it will not be done until the end of the morning that everyone receives this. But I want you to try to follow this comparison. You have animals. These animals are described in Leviticus 16 as part of a Day of Atonement sacrifice. There is in verse 23 here a reference that we need to make. It is necessary, therefore, that the patterns of things in the heavens should be purified with these. But the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. We really believe that the word sacrifices here in the plural means something more than just, let's say, a single sacrifice. Let's look at the chart together. The first box tells us the new covenant already was legislated. Meaning down, Christ was this better mediator. But we understand it has been established. But the question is this just Jesus Christ himself? Or is there more to the picture? Column 2. But the covenant will not be made or put into effect until the death of the testator. Well, you can say, well, that happened. Jesus is dead and raised already. But it says, until the better sacrifice sins, plural, which include, we believe, the church, are complete. So we're suggesting here that this is what happens when you have a reference to better sacrifices. Is it strange for us to expect God, to expect the church, to present their bodies a living sacrifice? To test them the way he tested Jesus Christ? To receive glory, honor, and immortality? Do we think that we could just walk in the door and say, I'm here, sign me up, Lord, I'll take that immortality. I'm ready for it. I don't think so. I think it's something that he put Jesus through a very severe test to prove him. I think he's proven, I'm sorry. I'm very sorry. I'll just conclude then. I'm very sorry. So, to give my thought, just to conclude this, that picture of the better sacrifices is described here for us, and the final point of this is that after the blood has been applied, and then the world has the benefit, they will receive both the legal atonement and the benefits of a merciful priesthood that has been developed through all these activities. In final thought, the very final words, it is a great privilege to even imagine ourselves to have the opportunity to be heirs with Christ and to benefit, to bless the world in this time. There will be a beautiful time, there will be a garden of Eden, there will be no serpent, the tree of life will be there for all, the water of life will be there, mankind will join in and say, you know it says in Revelation 22:17, it says, and I think it's important for us to remember this, for the sake of joy, the Spirit and the Bride say come, and let him that heareth say come, and let them who is athirst say come. The one that hears it says come. They come along with this package. They understand it. They join in. They participate. They understand it in the sense that they are willing to join in joy. May the Lord give us the strength and bless us with the ability to put forth our effort so that the blessings of the world will come soon, soon, soon. Lord bless you. Thank you for the privilege. Sorry I'm over time. I didn't realize that.